Everyone has a fave Wendy's Frosty flavor. And when you're choosing from chocolate or vanilla, it's not that hard. But now there's all new Frosty Swirls and Frosty Fusions. So try picking your fave from Oreo Brownie Fusion, Pop-Tarts Strawberry Fusion, Strawberry Swirl, Brownie Batter Swirl, Caramel Swirl, and Caramel Crunch Fusion. Not so easy now, huh? For a fresh way to Frosty, gotta be Wendy's. Open till midnight or later.
At participating U.S. Wendy's, hours may vary by location. Oreo is a trademark of Mondelez International Group. Pop-Tarts is a trademark of Kellogg North America Co., LLC. Used with permission.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Green Mulkin Lane podcast, where queer friends and allies gather to review and discuss the original X-Men comics in continuity order. We are going to be releasing this episode in July 2025, which means it is Colossus Month, which means you have heard a lot of my thoughts on this character already. He is complicated and there is a lot to say. Researching this guy made me an enormous fan of a character that I hadn't given a lot of thought to previously. While I was researching, I got to read Colossus's entire history, and I came across two of his writers. Well, people tangentially writing Colossus at the very least. Ben Rabb is back on the show, and I'm meeting Jorge Gonzalez for the first time. I'm so happy to have you both here. I'm going to ask you both to introduce yourselves with your name and pronouns. Let us know a little bit about your bio if you would like to. And then my intro question for you today is, what do you love about Pyotr Rasputin? We're just going to begin there. Let me welcome Jorge Gonzalez to the show. Hi, Jorge.
How are you? So very nice to be here. And great to see Ben, obviously. I've been a comic fan all my life. Love stories in all forms. Went to the Kubert School, and it's interesting. I've worked at a bunch of industries post that and keep encountering people from the Kubert School. But loved comics. From there, I got into Valiant Comics, thanks to Jose Delbo, who is one of the teachers at the school. Was there for 5 years, and it was great. Really got to see, you know, a comic book company from the ground up. It was Valiant during its really early days, and got to see it become a... It was just an amazing experience. From there, I went on to Marvel. It was funny. I was at Marvel at a time when, you know, it was their bankruptcy and they're like, it was like kind of a dark time on Marvel. So it was really an interesting time to be there. And nothing from there. I moved on and spent 10 plus years working in live action in the scenic department in New York, working in film and TV. And the last 7 years have been in California doing animation work for Warner Brothers and in mostly production, Young Justice, Harlequin, stuff like that. So all over the place.
That's excellent, Jorge. What is it that you love about Colossus?
For me, and I mean, I'm old school fan, so, you know, especially during the Cockrum and Byrne era, that Colossus for me was just kind of naive and just almost the heart and soul of the team. Like, he was very kind of the innocent kind of, you know, you have Wolverine, who's like super cynical, and, you know, and some of the other, you know, even Storm had been through her life, was not exactly easy. Colossus was interesting because he was such a powerful character, and yet, again, kind of a blank canvas, again, in terms of just really super sweet guy, you know.
They call him Petey Pureheart for a reason, and I love your metaphorical use of the canvas because he's the painter of the team. Now, listeners may know Jorge as the creator of the Fugly Mutant Twins, Corrosion and Dismember from the Sabretooth series. You may also recognize our other guest, Ben Rabb, as the incredible creator of Baroness Blood. Welcome back to the show, Ben.
Hey, Chad. Nice to be back. I appreciate you inviting me again. Love the show. You guys do a great job here.
Love you too. Ben, I'm picturing you sitting there one day thinking, you know, there's a Nazi vampire. We definitely need a lady version of that.
I mean, honestly, we had the male version, so there's really, you know, at the time there was a finite number of ways to go with it, right? You weren't really thinking of a transgender Nazi vampire, but they're like, okay, let's go to the female.
Living her best life.
Yeah, exactly. She was. Hi, I'm Ben Rabb. Anyone who might know me, I got my career start in comics. It did begin with sort of even before I got into the business. I was, you know, an X-Men fan from the early 80s and my childhood, who in the early 90s, when there was rumor that there was Nell Vanna was going to make an X-Men movie, I was like, I'm the nerd that's going to write that movie. So when I got to college, I wrote a couple of X-Men screenplays that were parts one and two of a trilogy, which I never finished. But those scripts did, I managed to get them in the hands of Terry Stewart, who was the president of Marvel at the time in the early 90s, just before the bankruptcy period began. And I landed an internship there. And I did that for a bunch of months until I finally got hired and became assistant editor in the X-Men office, which launched my career before I went freelance as a writer. For the past 15, 16 years, I've been working in television.
And what do you love about Colossus?
I've always been drawn to the strong characters. You know, as a little kid, especially, who, you know, I wasn't a big, strong guy. So there was something very appealing about these really powerful characters and seeing him stack up against characters like the Hulk or the Thing. And like, what, especially in the early 80s, once the Handbook of the Marvel Universe came out and you could sort of compare everyone's stats. And again, this was the who went in a fight age, Hulk or Thing, you know, that kind of stuff. Colossus was always up there. Just there's something, his look, he's got a great look, you know, compared to the rest of the X-Men. Like they all were so very unique and different, but something about him, obviously his stature, but like he just stood out. And once I got to write the character, that was a whole, added a whole other layer to my appreciation of who he is and what you can do with a character like that.
I have befriended multiple cosplayers through this show. There's like a category of cosplay where it's like a really fit gay guy and they all want to do this like sexy Colossus costumes, but they don't want to paint themselves silver. So I've had the question more than once from people, do you think I can get away with the costume, but I'm like in his like human form? Because I don't want to do the full metal painting. And I'm like, you get to decide your level of commitment here. But yes, there's a specific look to this character that makes him kind of magical. Now, we're going to jump into the kind of crazy realm that is Marvel's Russia. Now, Russia has an interesting thing. We've been talking about it a lot on my show this month, on both shows, actually. And the idea that, you know, the Iron Curtain, red bad guys was like the big thing in the 60s that every superhero got to punch. But with Colossus coming in, it kind of changed the game. We start to put a sympathetic voice to a civilian, and then we start to show kind of the horrors. But mostly when Russia is written in comics, in Marvel comics, it's usually capitalism fighting communism in some form, in some kind of way, even though we have a ton of Russian characters as the protagonists these days, with Black Widow and White Widow and Red Guardian being right at the front of that list in the new Thunderbolts movie. Colossus represents a really interesting piece of kind of that lore. And I want to start with the concept of kind of government corruption. When we go to Russia and there is the state and there is the military, you've got the KGB and the idea of kind of the civil uprising as kind of a constant backdrop. It is not an easy thing to delve into the complex history of this place. So Jorge, I'd love to have you start here if you would. You wrote Russia in a few different stories, but your Maverick series alone really put us in the heart and soul where you're showing a character named Ivan Pushkin, who's kind of got a kingpin energy over in Russia, but representing poverty in an odd way, or the exploitation of poverty, as well as his thugs Hammer and Sickle, which are, if you want to tell people a little bit about the Hammer and the Sickle and how you turned that into supervillains. So just tell us a little bit about your research and work in Marvel's Russia, if you would.
It's funny, the Pushkin character, I'd hoped to do a lot more with that, obviously, before Maverick, before the series kind of went away. But the idea was, especially at the time, I mean, we're still seeing that now in Russia, where these warlords are really kind of the ones who are, these corrupt businessmen are really kind of holding up the government, you know, or running the show. And with Pushkin was an opportunity to show that in the Marvel Universe. That's why I had introduced also that other Red Guardian character, and I'd hoped to do a whole kind of series of stories there where we get to see a little more of, is it Dark Star? Is that her name? Or there's all these other Russian characters there that pop up every blue moon in a Marvel book that would like to have kind of fleshed that out a little more and see them more as, because every time we saw, and I forgot what the name of that Russian group was called.
It changes every few years. It's currently the Winter Guard, but it's been the People's Protectorate and the Soviet Super Soldiers and about three other things.
But they were always used very much in like what you said, in the very, you know, the U.S. capitalists versus the evil Russia, you know, communist state. And it would have been nice to explore some of the nuances of these characters who are basically living under this system. They're, you know, not necessarily mean they're on board with the corruption. I was hoping with the Pushkin character to kind of get a little behind a little more of the everyman in Russia, and how they're dealing with all this. Throw into that also then the whole, how do they feel about mutants? You know, whereas the U.S. thing was was very, in the US, it was very clear from what Marvel had established in terms of, you know, the freaks, the minority, that whole kind of, would it have been the same in Russia? I would assume so, but I would assume they would have been exploited even more so.
I've done a couple of character episodes at this point. One of them is the character Ursa Major. I also have an episode out on the character Blind Faith, for those that know. Go listen to those two. We talk a lot more about Russia's complicated history with mutants at Marvel. It's way more crazy than you think. Jorge, do you want to tell everybody about what the hammer and the sickle is and how you created these characters?
Honestly, I like the names. I mean, they're such the symbol of the Soviet Union, you know, certainly at the time.
Yeah, the hammer and the sickle itself, this was interesting. It's a symbol they use to represent kind of the joining of the farming community with the industrial community. And it, like, they put it up on a banner, but really some of them are treated very, very poorly. And it's kind of like reinforcing the idea that we all have to give up everything for the government, if I'm allowed to be slightly critical. But it's really funny to see these turned into supervillains for me, because they're really fun villains.
Again, I was hoping to be able to, well, obviously see them more, but just flesh them out more during the course of this series that did not get a chance to do. Honestly, the whole series was really kind of a nod to, I'm a big Ian Fleming fan and James Bond, and it was that, and that was really kind of the whole Russian thing with Smersh and all of that was a nod to that. And to see what would that look like in that Marvel reality with powers and mutants and that kind of thing. That, again, we would have gotten to explore some of that with Hammer and Sickle and see a product of that system, you know, of these two brothers, basically.
They're pretty amped up villains. They're actually really fun. And you're writing Maverick at such an interesting time with all the legacy virus craziness. Jorge, listeners, is going to come back and do a Patreon episode with me on the character Elena Ivanova, who I'm very fond of. She was big in my brain in the way I think Jean Grey is big in a lot of people's brains. But I was reading Maverick during high school, and I really connected with that character. So I'm excited to talk to you more about
her. She had a lot of potential, definitely.
Certainly. Yeah, she's still in a coma, I think. It's been like 30 years.
That's funny.
We also did an episode on Chris Bradley recently, which is another one we got to talk about with a lot of your work as well.
That's cool. It's, you know, sad to me, like years later, I see Chris Bradley, very tragic end. Or does he end up, because Maverick kills him, or he kills...
He dies horribly at the hands of Maverick. It's really terrible, but I think he's back to life on Krakoa. They resurrected everybody, so it's okay. So Ben, let's talk about a little bit of your work with the character Colossus as well. In my initial interview with you, we talked a little bit about your Excalibur run, but you inherited Colossus right out of the hands of Warren Ellis, if I'm realizing correctly. Right after Piotr's parents had been murdered, his sister had died from the legacy virus, he joined the Acolytes, and boy, did that not end well. And it got worse after this, because he's getting ready to die of the legacy virus and get kidnapped up to Breakworld at this point. So do you want to talk about your work with Piotr? Petey Pureheart was not so pure in this era.
No, and part of that was a lot of weight to sort of throw on that character. And it's not like he couldn't handle it. I mean, the first issue of Excalibur I wrote, I focused on him because I felt like I want to get into him. I want to get under the skin of this character. I really want to figure out how to, you know, find another gear for him, because it's so easy just to make him tragic, which to me is really fucking boring. It's okay to happen once in a while, but it wasn't my experience with the character growing up. So I was like, I don't want to just repeat what's been done to him now. I want to find a way to sort of strike a balance between what's come before, you know, Warren Ellis, what Warren Ellis has done, and where I want to go with it. Building a friendship with him and Megan was important to me. You know, a little bit of an attraction too, because, you know, the Captain Britain, he was gone. So it's like there's room for that, just to sort of keep him alive and vibrant. And, you know, the one shot that I did with the two of them was just fun. I just wanted to have a good fucking time. And I wanted to remind people that Colossus can be a fun character if you let him.
So I do a giant academic panel on my show once a month. The episode coming out immediately after this will be a tribute to Piotr. So I have a whole panel of people. We're going to be talking all about Piotr, but I've written up a section on his love life. And it's so funny to me because he is so hearts in his eyes. He's so like, he loves the idea of love so much. Remember, he's like dating Kitty, who's a teenager. But then there's that healer on Battleworld, Zaji, and he's like, oh, sure, we'll be with you forever. Ever and ever.
Yeah.
So this man crashes to Earth. His entire family dies. He decides to join a team with his ex-girlfriend, who's fucking a new guy. And then he starts flirting with the girl that's getting ready to get married.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, no, he's, I mean, listen, I think that probably comes from, you know, having grown up on the farming collective in Siberia. He just wants love. The one thing that the communist government did not supply, love.
We do script readings on my show as well, and we just the old Claremont scene where Nightcrawler's like, hey, look at those girls in the miniskirts. And he's like, oh boy, Shamoy, I know girls did not wear skirts like that back in Siberia. Right. He's a really delightful character. Ben, you also did some really intense work. Buddy, I had to reread this story, and it's a rough one. You worked with the character Mikhail Rasputin in New Mutants Truth or Death. When I say rough, I don't mean poorly written. It's wonderful.
No, that's some of my other shit. That one I'm actually kind of proud of.
Mikhail, he's a bad, bad guy in this story, in that he tries to transfer his legacy virus to his little sister in the past. He's like, here, take my AIDS. That's the story that's being told. And it's really rough. Do you want to talk to us about New Mutants Truth or Death and your use of the character Mikhail Rasputin?
Yeah, I mean, part of it, I think, if I recall correctly, again, it's been over 30 years, or roughly 30 years, was the impetus was to try to explain, and maybe, I think, where did Ileana get it? Like, how did she get sick? What caused her to contract it? And at the same time that I get to have this fun adventure of the younger New Mutants meeting their future selves.
Yeah, that part of the series is amazing. It's really fun.
And just be right. I mean, because I was able to write, like, you know, both Rain Sinclair and Doug Locke in Excalibur, it was like, oh, cool. You know, these are characters who've been through some shit. Their younger selves have no idea what any of this is, you know? And the fact that Karma was back, like, it was, and so much had happened between those two lives of these characters. I mean, I got to do all that shit. And Mikhail, when he was introduced, I hated the notion that there was another Rasputin sibling. I don't like undiscovered siblings. I don't like the third Summers brother. I don't like any of that. That's just me and my takes, right? Like, I'm happy with what you've given me. Evolve and go forward from that. Don't go back and say, here's a secret you've never heard of. So it just sort of, it irks me.
Do you know, pause there for one moment. I want you to continue. But in Claremont's original run, his fourth issue on the book, X-Men 97, when they're going up into space to do the whole adventure with the Sentinels, and when they crash, Jean becomes the Phoenix. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Colossus gets on the rocket and has a panic attack. And when they reach out, he goes, this is how my brother Mikhail died.
Right.
It's mentioned from the beginning, but they didn't bring him into Wills Portacio 30 years later. I'm just giving context for
No. But he wasn't a mutant. He was his brother, the cosmonaut.
Yeah.
That to me was enough. You know what I'm saying? So it was like, okay, so now he's got to have these powers. And again, reality warping is a very ill-defined power set in my mind, because you can just do anything. So it's like, okay, you know, how do you, you know, neuter him a little bit? You know, you gotta deal with what's underneath it all. And the fact that this guy was just a horrible person who, you know, was so corrupted and become this opportunist, who saw a chance to survive something that he was not going to survive and would do it by any means necessary. So that was the thing that I wanted to get under with him.
We get to talk more about Mikhail today when we do our issue review, which is another crazy, this man is terrible. So we did a Patreon on him this month as well. I've already recorded it. He's a lot. Ben, let me lob one more question your way and then I'll turn it back to Jorge. When we first see Colossus as well, one of the early stories Claremont gives us, exploring kind of who he is as a person in relation to his country, is when they go to Murder World. Mm-hmm. And Arcade brainwashes him into becoming the proletarian. And even the word proletarian itself is just by, like, a member of the proletariat, or people who, like, contribute everything for the state, like a working class person. Mm-hmm. The costume is red overalls with a literal picture of Lenin, the hammer and sickle, and the letter CCCP across the top, which is the name of the country. It's as obnoxious as Captain America wearing stars and stripes, but way sexier.
Well, and he's got that cool little beanie too.
Yeah, a little red hat. It looks very Tom of Finland, if you know the reference, which is fun. You got to use that proletarian image in your Colossus one-shot as well. Do you want to talk about your choice of using that?
Yeah, I mean, how could I not? It's Arcade. You know, like, if you're going to have a story with Colossus and Arcade, you're gonna tread that ground. And again, it was all in an effort to, I don't want to say play the greatest hits, but at the same time, if you're going to have him try to move past what he's been going through, it's all part and parcel of it to me, you know? And again, not throwing in the kitchen sync, but at the same time, it is a striking image. It's a great cover, you know, like, so I'm like, all right, he's got, the proletarian's got to show up here.
The costume is crazy, but the picture of Lenin on the front pocket is just not, sure. It's yes. really crazy. We have a long conversation about Mikhail Rasputin as Lenin in my episode about him, which is really interesting. Jorge, you have an interesting grasp of continuity, and I know you didn't get to do nearly as many X-Men books as you'd liked, but one of your jobs, and I bought this in high school back when I was picking stuff up off the shelves, was the series Professor Xavier and the X-Men, where your task is to take the old stories and kind of tell them in the exact same way, but with some tweaks that, like, you know, give the decades a little bit more credence, that the time has passed in the world. It's not 1963, it's 1990 or 82 or whatever, right? How was it for you working on that series, which was kind of Saturday morning cartoon, early 60s comics energy?
Honestly, that was a lot of fun. That was the first work I did for Marvel. My tryout was an issue of that I did for Kelly Corvese, the editor at the time. And it was just a lot of fun. And it was an interesting book because, unlike the Spider-Man book that Busiek was doing, he got the leeway to, he could just create new stories set within that time period. Whereas we were very much restricted to, you have to retell each of these issues, you know, and basically try to tell something new about the characters. And the way we did that was we told each story from the point of view of a certain character, whether that was Jean Grey or the Beast, or sometimes it was Magneto.
Sometimes it was Bolivar Trask. Your arc on the Sentinels, expanding that Stan Lee original work, which is the best part of the original books, right? In the beginning, it's Juggernaut and the Sentinels is kind of all you need right there before the other creative team comes on later. But really well done on that arc. It's good.
Thank you. That was a lot of fun. It was a book that got a lot of flack, honestly, at the time, and it was dismissed because it was one of those 99 cent books and yada, yada, yada. But like I said, for me, it was a lot of fun to work on those characters and a great learning experience, too, that we'll be telling these, you know, these classics from Kirby and, you know, and Stan Lee with less of a page count than they had, but you had to tell more, you know, so there was a challenge in that, in how to make that work. So that was a lot of fun. Like I said, for me, that was a very positive, that was a fun series. I was sad to see it go, you know.
It was fun. I really enjoyed it. And it really opened up a whole world of comics for me because it made me want to go read the early stuff. That and
awesome.
Other, like
awesome.
It, like Untold Tales. And again, I went on to work on the handbooks later, right? So like that really meant a lot to me as a reader back then. You both love a really terrible villain. You guys can write some evil motherfuckers sometimes. Jorge, you created the character Catalyst for your Sabretooth Mystique series.
Oh.
He's like an evil, crazy Nazi sort, like a torturer kind of guy. And he's really brutal to Destiny in it as well, which is really sad. What do you love about a ridiculously evil villain?
Well, you got to have a strong villain. You know, it's part of what defines your hero character is, you know, the flip side of that is the villain. And when, you know, in this case, where it's a case where the main protagonists of the book are Mystique and Sabretooth, who aren't exactly saints themselves, you know, kind of have to ratchet it up a notch to, so you have a villain that is even more wretched.
Yeah, if you're writing two horrible people as your protagonist, you got to write a really horrible person. Then when you're writing Arcade versus Mikhail Rasputin, you know, as the examples presented, what do you love about a terrible villain?
Well, I mean, the thing I always loved about Arcade is that he's just an opportunist. He feels very relevant to today in a weird way, like billionaire who's got all this money and he chooses to do this shit and he'll contract out to whoever will fucking pay him. You know, so that's kind of timeless.
He's given real Batman villain energy for sure. He has a theme and he sticks to that theme. He fits right in that 60s show, right?
He's got a business to run. I mean, he contracts. That's the whole thing. He's got a business. He's a businessman. So that's kind of evil. Mikhail, again, somebody who preys upon the sympathies of his family, right? Like, it's pretty fucking sick.
When it comes to villains, it's interesting to create a counterpart to your hero, right? So when you're thinking about a villain for Colossus to fight, you're normally going to think Juggernaut. Like, that's going to be your first thought. Or the Hulk, like, who can punch harder? But when you get a little bit more subtle, Colossus has the idea of a lot of, like, madness in his family, right? His sister gets human trafficked to limbo by Valesco and like has a dark child side, a demonic nature. Colossus has always been afraid of the murderer kind of underneath, right? There's that whole arc again later where he is predicted to be the destroyer of worlds when it comes to that break world storyline. And then we've got the character Mikhail, who is written not always consistently, but the themes of I am insane and I need attention certainly really matter. He loves to have, I don't know, he's got like crazy borderline personality disorder. He'll murder a bunch of people and then be like, please feel sorry for me. I'll go sit in a hole for a while and I'll come back another time. Bye. Like, it's that story over and over with this guy. What are your thoughts on an arch villain for Colossus? What's a counter to this character that fascinates you?
It's tough because it's like he's not the center of his own universe. So his villains have always come from the group's shit, you know, collective antagonists.
That's an interesting question. Yeah like you said, the first instinct is like a juggernaut and kind of things like that. But more interesting, I think, would be someone outside of like Mikhail, the family kind of, you know, family knows where to push your buttons and all that kind of stuff. I see Petey as, you know, he's an artist, creates life, da da da. So someone who would be counter to that. I don't know what that villain would be. That's a great question.
When you read his history, it's really fun to see villains that challenge his morals, right? He likes to think of himself as a hero. So when someone makes him act in ways, and this is the story with Mikhail over and over again, including in this series, which we'll be reviewing in just a minute. But it's also interesting to see people question, you know, what does it mean to be a mutant is part of it. Like, I'm the patron saint of mutants in a lot of ways. Like, I'm one of the top five that you know. The way he left his country, though, he's literally a defector, and he was able to go and live a life with blessing, you know? So when you see, like, a villain who was unable to defect and got turned into a weapon, like a Mega Red, right? Or you take a character who chose to work for the country. Like, I stood for my country, you know, through everything, and you're the one that left. No matter the power sets, those create interesting moral conflicts for Colossus, which I think is really interesting. And in the series we're going to review in a little while, Colossus is going through a deeply moral journey.
I mean, like, when it comes to his morality, like, the fact that he was, the killing of Riptide, I know, is sort of like a seminal moment, which was really shocking at the time.
For context, because I have listeners who haven't read these stories. Okay. There's a group of mutants called the Marauders who are just slaughtering innocent people in a terrible hate crime on behalf of Mr. Sinister, who we're going to talk about next. Yeah. Colossus gets badly hurt by one of them, and with bodies at his feet already murdered by this person, he reaches out and grabs Riptide and snaps his neck. It's kind of a brutal murder for this kind of gentle character.
Do you remember when that happened? What,
like, during the fall of the mutants, like Uncanny X-Men 220s era?
It just seemed justified. It was shocking to see because that's not who he is, but I'm like, you know, I totally get it. Like, what else are you going to do? Nobody else was stopping this guy. He was, you know, whipping around, shooting that shit, you know, those little shuriken or whatever, those throwing stars that came out of him. And you're just like, this guy's got to go.
I get it. But Colossus sometimes will commit the murder and not be always in the right about it as well. Colossus also has a huge tendency to sacrifice himself. Again, after you wrote him, Ben, he cured the legacy virus by like acting as the catalyst, and it killed him. Like, I'll cure everyone in the world, but I myself will die, which we see him also make a choice in the issue we'll review today. Well, it's okay. I can sacrifice me.
Such a martyr.
Great. That's very much in Peter's character. This whole almost, that, like you said, that martyr kind of quality to him. It's inherent in the character, in his backstory, in the way his moral structure is set up.
He's more than just a farmer who turns into metal, right? Like, he has a lot of complexity. And it's interesting for me to line the siblings up too. And you look at the like Russian archetypes. Mikhail's the cosmonaut, and Ilyana's the witch, and Colossus is the proletariat. Right? It's an interesting vision of the three, how they are represented as well. We also have to talk briefly about Mr. Sinister. This is a villain who was just beginning to take his long, long journey as a supervillain when you guys were writing comics. By the late 90s, Sinister was the mad geneticist, but boy, by the time the mid-2000s came, he's gone through some things. This guy, what do you love about Mr. Sinister? He's maybe the biggest X-Men foe outside of Magneto, who is often one of the X-Men.
It's been a huge huge fan, to be honest. I mean, like, I you know what it is? It's partly because his history precedes the early history of the X-Men, right? And I understand that, you know, 1960s, Children of the Atom, all that shit, you know, but a guy who's operating in Victorian era times has a very different perception of the world than we did in the 60s about science and all that. So it is interesting. It is very mad scientist-y, and I think that is the cool side of his character. But he always, to me, he just felt his ultimate goals seemed vague and amorphous to me, you know? So I had a hard time connecting with him. I love this look, a great look. I mean,
oh yeah, the visual with the feathered kept cape and the big shoulder pads. And you hear that voice from the cartoon every time, right? Like, it's amazing.
Well, it's funny. I have similar thoughts to Ben as far as Sinister. I feel that way about Apocalypse also. I guess also because they're villains that came after my childhood almost, you know, like my growing up, my falling in love with the X-Men. But it took a while for me. I like Sinister more now, actually, than when he was first introduced. You know, I find it more interesting now in terms of all the, I guess because they used them to fix all the metal and, you know, that whole convoluted mess that they had to untangle, you know, that made him interesting in terms of like that being a geneticist and that there would be that kind of, there would be someone with that knowledge through his, like, that's an interesting concept. So I've kind of warmed up to him a little more now than when I was first introduced to him as a reader.
I find him exhausting. He's one of those villains that's just used so much. It's like Kang the Conqueror. If you're trying to write the Marvel Handbook entry of Kang the Conqueror, you need 3 months.
He hates his own book.
it's a lot because it weaves together in such complex ways. And Sinister's like that because he's written quite inconsistently. The retcons were there right from the start with Claremont, where we had, you know, the origin of like Sinister being involved with Scott at the orphanage when he was a kid. But as the time goes by, he's the crazy evil guy behind the Marauders. And then he turns into this weird geneticist. And then we go, oh, actually, Apocalypse made him back in like the Darwin times, and he's been around forever. I don't know if you guys read any of the Krakoa era books, but there was a whole huge storyline. They amplified one Sinister up to the level of like a cosmic god, which is so much. But we also learned when Sinister first got created, he also created three other versions of himself. So Mr. Sinister has the diamond on his head, and there's a version with a heart, one with a club, and one with a spade, and they all have
different
motivations.
No, they're all running around.
No, there aren't.
Yes, there really is.
No, you're lying.
I'm not lying.
He is not a fucking deck of cards. Does one have a Joker, too?
Wow. Also,
no one's done the Joker Sinister yet. That could be the thing. But they did make him a space god for a time. So when I say I'm a little tired of Sinister, you understand why. But there's three Sinisters. You get the really fun camp villain. Kieran Gillen's most known for writing this Sinister. If you guys have ever seen like a Cabaret, you picture like Joel Grey's character as the MC. He writes that Sinister. It's the very fancy gentleman who's like so obsessed with himself. It's hilarious. There's so much camp to it. And the white paint on the face already, right? The second one is the evil geneticist, which is very like the Jackal from Spider-Man. I'm just going to clone shit and mix shit together and, you know, manipulate bloodlines, and I'm obsessed with power. That's fun. But then we get the awful side, and that's the Sinister we're going to get today. We get the like racist, I worked in the concentration camps experimenting on Jews, and also like I've been manipulating bloodlines and murdering babies and wombs energy. And that's the Sinister we're going to see in today's series, and it's my least favorite version. I like the camp Sinister way more than the scary scientist one.
Well, he's certainly irredeemable at this point.
He's terrible. There's a modern story, again, this is Kieran Gillen, where someone asked him, like, weren't you racist? And he's like, oh, like, I took that out of my DNA, like, a few cycles ago. It was a waste of time. That's a literal line they put in.
Okay.
So today we're going to be reviewing, and I'm going a little bit, I'm breaking my rules. I like to do series that are set in the early continuity. This is not. This is a story that's set in the early 2000s, but it tells an early continuity story about Colossus, and it's one of the most Colossus-focused individual stories out there. We don't get a lot of those, unless it's like part of an ensemble team. You know, this is a very much a Colossus story. So this is X-Men Colossus Bloodline. It is from 2005 and 2006. The writer on this book is David Hine, with Jorge Lucas on pencils, Tom Chu on inks, Dave Sharp on letters, and our friend Mike Martz as the editor. Do either of you know David Hine? I haven't had the pleasure to meet him. I think he's a phenomenal writer. He did a lot of really great stuff at Marvel. So what I'll do is I'm going to read a brief summary of each issue, and then we'll pause to share thoughts. So in issue number one, we get these crazy covers on this book with Colossus just as this like centerfold model, like super amped up, showing off his biceps and thighs. It's very action posy. It's very Hulk-like.
I have worked with Tim. Tim was the inker on the X-Men books when I was the assistant editor. I loved him. He's one of the nicest guys and one of the best inkers in the business without question.
Excellent. What do you think of his rendition of Colossus on the first cover?
Oh, that's cool. It's really cool. But he did do the covers. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It always cracks me up how when you get muscly guys like this, it's really common, like even in real people, but like the head's just a little too small for the body because they're just so amped up. In issue number one, and this book is gorgeously colored and penciled. I really like it. It evokes a certain kind of Siberian frozen wasteland feel to the whole thing. It feels very austere and metallic a lot of the time with some like really gorgeous color splash. So we see a pale skinned man who is called the Pale Man arrive in a small town in Siberia. He's looking for a mutant named Yuri who heals people for money. Yuri is sitting in his room watching porn. There's a DVD that says Debbie Does Dubrovnik. Amazing. He's wearing headphones and like eating chips. He's living his best life. He's not masturbating. He's just eating chips and watching porn with headphones, you know, because mom and dad are in the next room. So the Pale Man enters and then like eviscerates this guy, like drains his energy. He looks like he got burnt up in a fire by the end. We jump to the X-Mansion where Pyotr Rasputin is having a nightmare of being trapped in a room. So after he died from the legacy virus, he ended up stuck in a tomb on an alien world for a long time before getting rescued. So he's got a little bit of PTSD from all that solitary confinement, which is cruel when we're going to get to issue 5 in just a little while. So he punches his way free. That's where he wakes up. And Emma Frost can tell something is off, but he does not care. It is none of your business. We go back to St. Petersburg. We meet a reporter, and this is my favorite character in this series, Larissa Mischenko, who's pushing her publisher to write the truth about some crazy murders that have been happening. She references real life reporters, and they use the actual photos of these men in the book. Paul Klebnikov, Valery Ivanov, and Alexei Sidorov, who are all newspaper editors who were murdered by hitmen in Russia after writing about corrupt government policies. Real stories, that's a jarring thing to consider 20 years later in 2025, as we still see stories like that. In order to cover her tracks, Larissa has a friend, Tanya, dresses her and go to the movies so that she can go off and do her work. But the Pale Man both murders Tanya, the friend, and the guy that was going after her to kill her with a gun. He leaves them both burnt up again. We jump back to the X-Mansion where Pyotr is painting in dark reds, but he covers up his work to hide it from Kitty. We don't know what the painting is of at this point. He tells her, there's something not right inside me. Emma enters. She wonders, were you painting Kitty nude? And he's like, no. And then she says, oh, true. Some people are more interesting with their clothes on, as she gives Kitty some side eye, which is really amazing to me. It's very Golden Girls. I love it. Pyotr's had a distress call from his cousin Larissa, so he rushes all the way to St. Petersburg, where we meet a man named Kirill, who has a pink mohawk. He's a big fan of Colossus, and he takes Pyotr to Larissa. She's been tracking the murders. She's learned that there are dozens of victims, and quote, I'm not doing a Russian accent, we don't have a large family, Pyotr. Most of our relatives have died over the years. Ilyana, your parents, my mother and father. Then there was Uncle Vladimir. Mad Uncle Vlad, says Pyotr. He had 3 children, Konstantin, Clara, Dmitri, and we see images of all 3 of these kids murdered by the serial killer as well. All the victims were connected to the Rasputin family line. Quote, when my parents died, I was left a trunk containing the possessions of our great-grandmother, Elena. She was born in Siberia, but went to St. Petersburg with her twin brother, Ivan. She returned without Ivan, but carrying an illegitimate child, our grandfather. She gave the child his father's name, Grigory Efimovich Rasputin. Meanwhile, back at the X-Mansion, Kitty uncovers the painting, which is a self-portrait of Colossus as a monster dripping with blood, it looks like. Okay, I know I just covered a lot of ground. That first issue had a lot packed into it. Ben, what were some of the things that stood out to you?
I thought it was a really good introduction to set up the story. Like, it was all very compelling and very intriguing. And what kind of story are you going to do for Colossus that hasn't been done before, right? Him dealing with the political side of things, the journalism, that there's this thing going on, that he's got a cousin that we've never met before. You know, homecoming is all very interesting, you know, and whatever you know, the nightmare he was having at the top, which, like you said, comes back later. I thought it was a very good setup. Like, just issue one, I think, did a really good job of setting up what this story is going to be. I think it's I can imagine the pitch was, it's about time we address the fact that his last name is Rasputin, right?
Thank you. Yeah.
Like that feels like that's I don't know how David Hein pitched it to Mike, but I imagine that somewhere in there was like, are we ever going to tell a story that connects these two things? And I thought this was a really cool way of setting it up.
So let's introduce this very quickly. Grigori Rasputin, who Peter's grandmother or grandfather was named, we just learned, is a real historical figure. Grigori Rasputin was born in Siberia in 1869 as a peasant, and in time he became a wandering, self-proclaimed holy man and developed quite a following. Very odd guy. He'd like brag publicly about like not washing his underwear for weeks at a time. Just a real interesting person. And he was very focused on like getting all of the brides and like young girls that he could. Very cult leader energy. In 1905, he ended up introduced to the Russian royal family, the Romanovs, who brought him in to heal Tsarina Alexandra's hemophilia. And over the next 10 years, he developed super high influence within the court of the king. So Russia was a monarchy at this time. That started resulting in like the amping up of rumors and political controversy. And in 1916, Grigori Rasputin was murdered. And in 1918, the Romanovs were murdered as well, paving the way for the Soviet Union to form under communist rule in 1923 instead. So this is a huge moment in Russian history. And yes, I just told you the plot line of the cartoon Anastasia. If you watched that growing up, Rasputin's the big bad guy with the little flying talking bat. And we are now revealing in this story that he is Colossus's great grandfather. He fathered a child through his great grandmother, Elena.
Again, like Ben said, it's about time the Rasputin connection was made. It's certainly, Rasputin's a fascinating historical figure. You know, good Lord, if you wanted to make Didi's story more tragic, adding this basically baggage to him with is huge. So I certainly do like all this, exploring some of this, getting back in Russia. I like that the miniseries is dealing with that. I think it's an interesting premise for sure.
And did you have thoughts on Emma commenting on Kitty should not be nude for paintings?
I have comments on what Emma's wearing in that, you know.
It's very Blanche talking to Dorothy. Like it just... makes me smile. And then, Ben, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that final painted image. We see the self-portrait of Peter reflecting the fear of what he is inside. This mean, bloody murderer, basically.
Well, I think it's fairly accurate. I mean, that is who he is.
Well, no? that's what Riptide would paint.
right? I mean, honestly. No, I mean, it's cool. It also evokes, I think, a very, like, to me, this whole setup, maybe it is because Mike Mignola had used, you know, Rasputin so effectively in Hellboy. Just the look of the art and everything very much feels like, hey, let's capture a little bit of that Hellboy vibe. And this was a nice added layer to that, I thought, through the painting. And again, just his own self-loathing.
So here's my early thoughts on the review of this series. And I always find things to love because otherwise, why would I do what I do, right? It's not fun to just poke critiques at things. Right. I think this starts and ends very strongly as a Colossus story. But the entire middle, it becomes just a story about ancient history that I'm not sure we needed. And we'll talk more about it, but I do think the bookends, the 1 and 5, are very good at telling a Colossus story when it's his name on the book. When we jump to issue 2, we're back in Lake Baikal, which is where Pyotr grew up. There's a bearded madman out there. This is the Uncle Vlad they referenced earlier, who's gone crazy. He traps a rabbit. He's singing to himself. We go back to St. Petersburg. Larissa is suggesting that Grigori Rasputin, the historical figure, might have been a mutant. Peter ends up changing to metal. He beats up some cops that are after them. He's wondering what's happening to him. He feels like he's going mad. And Larissa believes that the madness runs in their family. Look at Ilyana, who has a literal dark child. Look at Mikhail, who's basically committed genocide at this point. And we referenced the legacy virus story earlier. This is not a good person. Even Larissa is struggling with depression, she says. And she shows him the scars on her wrists that show she's struggling. They end up finding Uncle Vlad back at Lake Baikal, but they're followed by the Pale Man. And he unmasks, you're expecting it to be Grigori Rasputin, but it's fucking Mr. Sinister. And behind him in the shadows, we learn on the first page of the next issue, it's fucking Mikhail Rasputin.
A great reveal with Sinister at the end, because I wasn't expecting that. I mean, I will say my biggest issue with the story is it was really that I wish Peter would have gotten more agency. I felt he was almost, like you said, especially in the issues 2 and 3, it's like a spectator in his own story, more than having, you know, that he's not the one driving this story. He's being manipulated by all these different forces and given a big history lesson. Again, I do like, and the artwork certainly fits though when I'm looking at it, the mood of the story and the creating that bleak, what it is like. I don't know if you've ever been to a communist country that's in decline and that it's bleak.
It's a beautiful book for sure. They really did a cool job with the color on those pencils. Yeah. I think it's nice.
And again, for a character that I always saw as, despite his own self-loathing and his darkness, clearly a very moral character, or trying to be, and kind-hearted. So it's just tough seeing him get more piled on him. That's just this darkness in his family, like this multi-generation, you know, like feeding into his self-loathing.
Odd take that I just thought of, but is Colossus the Daredevil of the X-Men? Which is an interesting thought experiment. You just dump and dump and dump on the guy. Poor thing. Ben, when you saw Mikhail, did you think, oh, it's my favorite character, my old buddy Mikhail Rasputin is back?
I did not. Because again, it's one of those things. Like, I like the character. I feel like there's a finite number of things you can say with him. Again, and I also didn't. I don't. What I knew about him reading this, like, there's what I wrote, and then there's stuff that came after. And right. I was unaware of the bridge between the two. So for me, it's just like, okay, I'm seeing this guy again, and what's new and different about him? He's been trapped in a void. Okay,
cool. When we put it out, I'll tell you, or I'll give you the link to the Mikhail episode if you want to listen. It's interesting. But Jason Aaron did some really cool stuff with this character in some recent comics. Actually, it's really great. Jumping to issue 3, this is like, you just take Colossus out of the book. He's not even here, basically. We have Mr. Sinister giving a very long, detailed flashback about his time in the Darwinian times. If you read Further Adventures of Cyclops and Phoenix, beautiful book, you learn how he lost his wife and became a crazy geneticist for Apocalypse, and was basically tasked with like seeking out what he calls the Essex factor. But here we get like supremacist Nazi Sinister, who is just basically seeing everyone as inferior races. We see him use the term mongrel race. We see him use the phrase congenital idiots and cripples. We also see him directly commenting on wanting a pure bloodline. Of course, David Hyde does not stand for any of these things, but it's always so, I don't know, when you write the Red Skull as a comedic supervillain, it's kind of fun. But when he starts talking about mongrel races, you just remember why superheroes exist in the first place, because these are the worst. So we learn that Grigori, again, the historical figure, was instructed to father as many children as he could through his, quote, celestial brides. Sinister injected some stuff into all of the fetuses of the impregnated women, which would increase their likelihood of being mutants. And one of these women was the only one, the only celestial bride, quote unquote, that Grigori actually loved, which was Colossus's great-grandmother, Elena, who again had a twin named Yvonne. Yvonne ends up turning on Rasputin, and the public turns against him. And if you remember, I mentioned he got assassinated. Now, in this version of the story, he's like a magic sorcerer guy, and also maybe a mutant. And somehow he does a thing where he passes part of himself on into all of his grandchildren, which is an odd story about hatred, I suppose. And like, the more generations go by, the more the programming changes. The idea here is that he is inspiring madness in each of his heirs, because he's inside each of his heirs. Then we jump back to the present, where Uncle Vlad has lit himself on fire. Ben, do you have thoughts on issue 3 and the revelation of Grigori and his, I don't know, brood mares?
Again, this is one of those things why I didn't like this, the Sinister backstory, which is like, here we're seeing, like, there's the moment where we're seeing, it looks like Colossus's ancestors have some sort of mutant ability. He's levitating her in front of a crowd. It's magic. It just, to me, all this kind of stuff undermines the conceit of mutants. And when mutants come into the world and become a thing, it's like, so, and again, I know we have other instances like Apocalypse or whatever, but that precede the Marvel Universe. but it adds another layer that makes me ask questions that I don't want to be asking while I'm reading the story. It takes me out of the story. It makes me go, I guess you can get away with it within the context of this particular tale, but in the larger tapestry of the Marvel Universe, it feels a little disjointed. And again, I mean, look, Rasputin lighting himself on fire, Vlad lighting himself on fire. We will get to know why in the next issue, but Peter's not doing anything. He's just standing there. He's hearing the story. This is where, to me, I was like, oh, was this just an excuse to tell a Mr. Sinister story that's kind of already been told?
And right, because Frank Thierry wrote Mr. Sinister in Auschwitz, experimenting on Jews. Like, he met Magneto when he was a kid. We also have those old Black Womb stories or Alamo Gordo. Mike Carey did a story with Sinister experimenting on Charles Xavier in the womb. Like, this guy has had his hands in everything. Oh, wow. That's where he gets really exhausting sometimes.
He's like a genetic tourist throughout time.
I'm going to tell you, I'll give you this fact really quickly, and it would make me mad, except the stories are really fucking well written. Do you remember the other three Sinisters I mentioned? So this Sinister with the diamond, Mr. Sinister, is obsessed with mutant science, and the guy with the spade on his head is called Dr. Stasis. He's obsessed with human science. And the guy with the club on his head, I think I'm getting these right. I might have mixed those two up. His name is Orbis Stellaris, and he's obsessed with cosmic science. And then the one with the heart is a lady, and her name is Mother Righteous, and she's obsessed with magic. Like, it's like Sinister sent versions of himself out, kind of like Multiple Man would. Like, hey, go learn all you can about everything, and then bring it back to Daddy.
I still can't get past the card thing on the forehead. That makes no sense to me. Interesting scene, like this whole image of Vlad on setting himself on fire. I'm like, this was certainly not flown in a comics code.
Yeah, this is a different era. This is the violent era of comics, for sure.
No, early 2000s.
In issue 4, and I'm over-summarizing a few things, Yvonne died. Sinister reveals that he's basically been killing all of the Rasputins as the Pale Man, because every time he does, a little bit of Grigori Rasputin will gather in all of the others. So picture like a demon that's possessed a bunch of people. Every time someone dies, the rest of them get a little stronger. It's very Phoenix 5 with the Phoenix Force, for those that read that story a few years back. So eventually the mind of Grigori will maybe be able to take over one of the heirs. Oh, this is very Lovecrafty too, now that I'm thinking about it, actually. This is a super Lovecraft story. So Mikhail is involved because he thinks, I'm already mad. I've been hanging out in another dimension all by myself. Nobody noticed I was gone. So I needed some attention and I came back to Earth. And if I kill all of my relatives, then Grigori Rasputin couldn't go on and live in my body and have access to my reality altering powers. Great plan, buddy. if that's really what's going on. But before that, he's like, after I get him inside me, I will go off in a dimensional void and then just give up on my life. Like, if you care about me, then you'll call. So Sinister kills Larissa, which is horrible. Single touch to the neck, she's gone. And then Mikhail takes Colossus into another dimension. He tells Sinister, I'm going to go kill him. But he's like, hey, I'll just leave you here for a few decades. He's done this to this man like 4 times. If you get really lonely in another dimension, then you'll understand how I feel, Piotr. It's very the energy. Piotr attacks. He's like, if I'll kill you. I'll throw rocks at your head. And, if I kill you, then Grigori can come inside me. And then I can live in the dimension all by myself forever and ever. Well, doesn't that sound better, Mikhail? And Mikhail just leaves him there instead. Like, bye. And he's like, no, not the dark place.
Poor Colossus, man. They just keep shoving him in a in a hole, basically.
He's such an easy target, right? Like, because he's such a good person, because he's so moral, yeah. So ethical, because he's so sacrificial, fucking martyr. Yeah, sure.
I really hate that they killed Larissa. I think, let's introduce an interested, educated, rebellious woman who's related to Colossus. That's a character who has potential, but she just gets touched and is gone. I think that was an unnecessary part of the story. I think she could have survived and it would have made the story stronger, if I'm honest.
Well, she was like a Russian Lois Lane. Like, there was potential for that character. Like, I wrote a journalist character in the X-Men Hellfire Club miniseries to sort of unearth the origin of the Sebastian Shaw and his family. So I get like that's why this sort of appealed to me from the beginning with her. I was like, oh, this reminds me a little bit of that. And I'm curious to see what this spy thriller kind of, murder mystery journalism thing is going to be. And then she's also just a bystander for most of the story.
I'll definitely have you back on to talk about the Hellfire Club Limited today. We'll get there. We're creeping up closer.
Cool.
Finally, issue 5, we see Piotr stranded in the other dimension, but then there's this big reveal. I don't understand why this revelation was such a big deal. We go back to the past again, and Elena, the great-grandmother who's pregnant with the son that will be named Grigori, she tells Grigori, like, I will go kill my brother Ivan. Like, just don't come out. And then she comes back with blood on her hands, and she's like, oh, he's dead. But because there was, like, a secret necklace being worn, Mikhail realizes, oh, Elena didn't murder great-grandpa Ivan, which means I should still care about Colossus, even though I've slowly watched every other relative that I've ever cared about, including my cousin, who I really like. Everyone needed to die, but now I've had a change in heart because I saw this necklace. I don't like this reveal. So he brings Colossus out of prison, and then Mikhail basically says, Sinister has been mentally manipulating me this whole time. The only reason I got control back is because I was away in this other dimension with you for a minute. I don't buy it. I think Mikhail made that up. It's very... He's covering his tracks. And then Colossus, who promises I will never kill anyone in anger ever again, decides to let Mr. Sinister escape. Mikhail departs. He's like, I will now go off into another dimension. Feel bad for me. I hope you remember that I exist. Goodbye. Again, very borderline personality disorder. And then Colossus takes his grandmother's amulet back to the X-Mansion and sits in front of it, holding it, his family legacy in his hand, while looking at this portrait he's painted of himself as a crazy monster. Jorge, what are your thoughts on the conclusion of this series? As we're talking about it, I don't know that I understand exactly what it was trying to accomplish, but it's a solid fucking story. It's good.
It's interesting. It brings up, I mean, again, I love all the look at a return to Russia and a look at that. I agree that a loss of Larissa's character was a lot of story potential. And just to have someone, I mean, because at this point, have they killed off Ileana and his parents too, are already dead by this point?
Yeah. So
you have someone to connect to.
In the early 90s, Fabian Nicieza did that story with the Soul Skinner, where they go back to Russia and there's a deadly mutant. So the government storms the house. They're going to age Ileana back into adulthood so she gets her powers back. And his parents are gunned down. And then Ileana, at age 7, gets the legacy virus and dies. Like, he's on a rough journey for a while here.
And it seems like this just piled on more, as opposed to some resolution, you know. Like,
which is why Ben gave us a joyful Colossus and Excalibur, right?
Well, I'm looking for him. Let's guy have some laughs. It's been really shitty for him this whole time.
Again, he's the Daredevil of the X-Men, I think.
Yeah, no, you're right.
Ben, what were your thoughts on the conclusion of this series?
So here's the thing. The image at the end of him sitting in front of the painting, we've already seen it. That was blown in issue 1, right? Like, had they been able to hold that off, I think maybe it would have been a little bit more powerful. Or different image that we didn't expect. You know what I mean? So that it's not just like, again, ending on this broody, morose Colossus. I mean, the backstory of him being trapped as a kid and the brother saving him and, you know, doing it again, that was great. That felt like this is what this story was meant to be about. And I wish that the interim issues had built that story where brother and brother get to sort of reconnect with each other and you know, put the past trauma behind them and move on with a new beginning. That's what I would have liked. It could have been sacrificial and all that shit. Mikhail could have ended up, you know, in the dimension doing whatever it is, sacrifice. It's all cool. But like, I just wanted more about the story of these two brothers.
Yeah, I think it's very much a story about the monster inside me. Mikhail says, I only acted in this way because of Sinister manipulating me. But also the story for all of the Rasputins is we had this evil in our blood the whole time. There's like been madness, like mutant madness within us. So is Grigori Rasputin, the one possibility is that he cast a spell and like put himself into the minds of his descendants, right? Again, very Lovecrafty. But the other is like his mutant power is to like animate himself in other descendants. I don't know. There's it's like a multiple man thing, right? Like I can transfer my consciousness into a dupe almost energy. It hasn't quite been explained. And Grigori Rasputin has been used in other Marvel comics over the years, often as like a spirit at unrest. If you go look up his Wikipedia, you can find some of that. Interesting thought experiment. I don't like the Sinister part. We love a supervillain, but I don't like Frank Thierry's Sinister very much. And this is very much Frank Thierry's Sinister.
again, for me, I would have liked to have seen Colossus end up in a better headspace, because I agree with Ben that I would have liked to have seen that the relationship with his brother really is the emotional core of the story. That would have loved to have seen more of that.
Jason Aaron again did that very well in his. Okay. It's quite good, the story he wrote between the two of them. But
where does that fall between with this?
So this came out in 2005. This came out in 2005. Jason Aaron wrote that in like 2022.
Quite
recent. But Peter gets dumped on. He gets mind controlled for like a whole year, and he has to murder his girlfriend. Like it's rough. It's a rough time. he rips Mikhail's heart out of his chest at the end of the
story. Jesus. Okay.
Well, as one does.
So he got off easy on this one.
Right?
Gentlemen, it is a pure joy to just have men of your talent and caliber. So thank you for spending this time with me. I had a great time with you both today. I'd love to hear any final thoughts. We're going to put this up for listeners on July 24th. And if you'd like to share any final thoughts, where can people find you online? Anything you would like to plug? Let's go, Ben, and then Jorge.
I just want to, given where we are in time when you're recording this, Peter David just passed away. And I feel like we should give a shout out to someone who was part of the X family and X Factor, one of the great writers in Marvel Comics history. I had the fortune / misfortune of following Peter David on his epic run on Spider-Man 2099. I wrote the last two issues when the series had been canceled. So how do you follow? I mean, listen, I had a long history of following much better writers in my career. And it was really an honor to be able to sort of play with Miguel O'Hara for a couple of issues and something that Peter David was so integral in creating, and it's a real loss to the business and to comic fandom.
We're recording this, everybody, in late May. I told you I do an academic panel once a month, and the day we're recording this, I just released our academic panel about Jamie Madrox, the Multiple.
Oh, wow.
And boy, do we talk about Peter David, because I feel like that's his signature character. It's like the Hulk, Genus Bell, and Multiple Man, that's not a fair trio. But he's just a phenomenal talent, and yeah, it's still a very fresh wound. But may he rest in peace. I understand Amen. He was quite ill, and it's always a relief to know someone's no longer in pain at the same time.
I spent the past year recording music of my own, which I would love to have people listen to if they feel so inclined. It's on Spotify.
I would love to. Is it under your name?
Yeah, no, it's not under my name. I record under my musical pseudonym is Idle Hands.
Okay.
My most recent album came out a few weeks ago. It's called Elsewhere. It's all instrumental. It's all, home produced. It's just a thing that I've always wanted to do, and finally got the courage to get up and do it. And as I did with my comics career, I'm putting it out there for everyone to be critical and hateful of it if they want to be.
I look forward to listening, Ben.
Thank you. Yeah, that's other awesome. Than that, working on an online game. It's called Best Concert Ever. You can find it. It's a free website. You can go. You can play a game every day. There's a new musical prompt where you get to play the role of concert promoter, and you pick an opening act, a second opener, and a headliner. And it's a different theme, different genres each day. People, the audience gets to vote on it. It's just a fun little, thing you can do. People wanted to check that out. That would be awesome. It's bestconcertevergame.com. And the last thing is a little early to announce, so I won't give the full details, but I'm going to be doing some work back in the publishing world, in the comics publishing world, with an indie publisher that does not just traditional American comics. They do manga and manhwa, Korean manga, cool. Which I'll be doing something for them.
That's
excellent. Cool.
Ben, this is going to sound like such a small thing. Last summer, I went to New York Comic Con, and I was just kind of wandering around feeling like an outsider loser by myself. And, there's people here I know, but they don't remember me. And even though I've interviewed some, Ben came like storming across the aisle. Chad, it's so good to see you. And that like warm welcome, like set a trend for the rest of the next 3 days that I was there, that it just turned out to be lovely. So thank you for just being a kind, lovely person. It was really nice to meet you in person last year.
Listen, I was there by myself as a loser as well. So I needed to gravitate toward others.
But even the fact that you recognized my face in person meant a lot. I really appreciate it, man.
No, of course not. I was there for John Cassaday's memorial. That's why I was in town for that specifically. So, my dear friend and collaborator, and I know we all miss him too.
Well, for me, as far as what I've been up to, I mean, I've been working in animation for the last 7 or so years in the production side of things. things. So Young Justice, Harlequin are some shows, Mike Tyson Mysteries, stuff I worked on, a lot of fun. Right now, I'm actually going back into writing. It's been a long time. I've been out of it for a while. So diving back into it with a friend of mine working on a series of graphic novels that we're going to be shopping around in the next couple of months. So too soon really to say anything about it, but we'll definitely let you know once we're up and running. And hopefully I may even go to, it's funny, I haven't been to New York Comic Con in many a years, you know, I may try and go this year. I've reconnect with a lot of old friends I have there that I haven't seen in a while. So I'll definitely keep an eye out for you if you're there.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I'm going. I'm going for FlameCon a few weeks before. I'm pretty sure I'm going to NYCC. And for sure, I would love to grab a coffee or a cocktail. It'd be great to meet
awesome.
You.
Awesome.
Okay, lastly, I keep my own social media private because I got kiddos, but follow the show at @GrayMalkin_Lane. And what you can watch for on the show next week, it will be the trial of Pyotr Rasputin. So watch for that. I have an incredible lineup of guests and it's going to be a really thought-provoking episode. If this one made you think, that one's going to make you think more, I promise. Over on the Patreon, we're covering characters tangential to Colossus. So the next episode after this, watch for one on classic Marvel supervillain, The Presence, and his wife, Starlight. Very interesting comments to talk about on those two characters. And then we're closing out the month on the Patreon channel with Jorge rejoining me. We're going to talk all about Elena Ivanova from the Maverick series. All right, everybody. Thank you for listening. Thank you to Ben. Thank you to Jorge. We'll see you all back here next time on The Grey Malkin Lane Show. And now stay tuned for some thoughts on fascism as a special guest and I talk about a Red Skull story and its modern application.
I like that I'm at a point where meeting you feels like an honor and I'm not a scared, nervous wreck anymore. So that feels okay, here we go.
In 1938, Germany annexed Austria. In 1939, Czechoslovakia and then Poland. In 1940, Denmark and Norway and Belgium and the Netherlands and Luxembourg. Meanwhile, the Soviet Union expanded into Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. Pressured from the overwhelming threat, Hungary, Romania, and Bulgaria all allied with the Axis powers, feeling they had no choice, while Greece and Yugoslavia were invaded. In 1941, Germany invaded Russia, including Belarus and Ukraine, and with their resources spread so thin, this is where the movement began to fall apart. Let's jump over to Astonishing Tales number 4 and 5 for a crazy story where Dr. Doom has just settled an uprising from rebels in Latveria because Prince Rudolfo tried to reclaim the throne, and then he went on vacation, literally just soaking in the sun to relax after quelling the civil war. And while he was gone, in swoops the Red Skull and his Nazi elderly exiles there to take over, realizing that the civilians there will have little ability to resist their rule. And from this new power base, they can rebuild the Fourth Reich, which is a phrase we're going to see 1,000,000 times from the Red Skull in the future. They attack the civilians. They conquer the villages first, and then take the ruined castle, Doomstadt, itself. They hang swastikas immediately. They assemble a bunch of old loyalists. There's this panel of the Nazis all raising a salute and a bunch of old, wizened Nazi soldiers who've come out of the woodworks joining the Nazi parade with their arms up in the Heil Hitler pose. And immediately, when Dr. Doom returns, he is captured. They put him in a public coffin in a living kind of death to be humiliated by the public, and they're planning to slowly cook him to death in front of everyone. But of course, he escapes. While he is going through this, though, the Nazis immediately on the page begin sending the old, the sick, and the subversive to concentration camps. And they start beating any civilians who are disobedient or who ask too many questions. But Dr. Doom, of course, frees himself. He defeats the exiles. He hypnotizes them all into believing that they've been shrunk to the size of 6 inches high. And then he fires them on a little rocket into the atmosphere. The Nazis have been repelled and Latveria was saved by a less dangerous despo, Dr. Doom himself. There's a recent story in Marvel Comics where the evil of the Red Skull has been defeated, and in swoops Dr. Doom to take over the world, which is what's happening in Marvel Comics right now, which is interesting, but he's definitely the less evil version. This also sets up a future confrontation we'll be talking about on the show. Dr. Doom and Red Skull fight more than once. Let me welcome my esteemed and incredible guest, my friend Annie Nesenti, to the show to talk all about this crazy story. Annie, this is my first question for everyone. Are you a fan of the Red Skull?
You know, I never wrote a Red Skull story, so I don't know anything about Red Skull, but other than he was, I don't know who created him. I mean, these stories that you sent me have Dan and his brother Larry, the Lieber brothers, really, who were writing this. And so this goes back to, I guess, the origins of Captain America. America, how it was the Jewish creators that reacted to how the, like you put it at the beginning, your little talk about how they were invading all the countries across Eastern and Western Europe. Captain America was created as a pointed directive to Roosevelt that we should stop Nazis. Red Skull is obviously a Nazi.
Red Skull is Hitler's protege. There's a story where Hitler back in the World War goes, look at this man, this bellhop in this hotel. I can turn him into the greatest evil. I'll give him a costume. And anyway, he becomes Captain America's arch nemesis. And he's this kind of returning threat of fascism, the low level measure of evil in Marvel Comics forever and ever. It's crazy that this is a kid's story, right? Like they're literally pushing Nazi propaganda immediately into Latveria as they take over. Concentration camps and salutes and swastikas. Like it's right there as soon as they take over.
Interesting, because I never really thought of Marvel Comics as stories for kids. You know, I think the readership was always quite a bit older than that. In fact, Marvel at different points and DC have tried to capture the younger market, you know, but they haven't been all that successful. So I never thought of these stories as for kids, even though kids did read comics. But yeah, I think we saw the Red Skull. Who created the Red Skull, by the way? Because of Captain America being...
Red Skull was created by Jack Kirby and Joe Simon.
Oh, okay. So that's perfect. That's exactly who created Captain America. And they two Jewish creators who came into the comic field at a time when anti-Semitism was so severe in New York City that they couldn't get work in the normal ways that artists got work, which was the advertising industry. And so, but they found that no one cared that they were Jewish in the comic industry. It would have been Timely back then, I think, and it would have been Martin Goodman maybe. But so it was a full year before Pearl Harbor that Captain America came out, famously punching Hitler in the face. So these stories were driven by two Jewish kids who were you know, anti-Semitism was really impacted on their lives.
Yeah. The story here, and again, it's kind of a silly story and it's drawn in cartoons, but we see a country that is in a vulnerable state and some evil ideas start to spread. They start in the villages, they start in the civilians, and then they build a base of power before going toward the capital itself and immediately hang the swastikas, right? There's a very uncomfortable parallel to what we see happening in America these days, which conversation.
You know, in the early 90s, when we all saw the rise of Trump and everyone thought of him as, because if you were in New York in the 80s, you knew this guy Trump was around, and he was famous for not paying workers, for building shitty buildings that would fall down, you know, that would have a lot of problems, for discriminating against Black people and not giving them housing. I mean, he was a real shitbag back then. And I did a Batman comic where I had the gold tee being risen higher on the skyline as Trump built a building that basically cast a shadow over New York and blocked the light of everyone else. And it was a symbolic story, obviously, about him as a shitty con artist. You know, to see 40 years later him still at it. You know, and all the parallels in this of the symbols, like him wanting his name Trump everywhere, you know, and wanting to add himself to Mount Rushmore.
Gold
everything. And, you know, and he's being hustled now, like that cutter jet. They've been trying to sell that thing for so long that what's wrong with that jet? It's way too heavy. It's too big. I don't think it makes any sense. So, you know, he's getting conned all the time himself. But the parallels to today, reading this little story you sent me, the parallels are completely, that's sort of what's sad is it's kind of like nothing has changed.
Yeah.
You know, here we are shoving immigrants into detainment centers where not even a congressman can go make sure the conditions are okay in there, and the reports coming out are horrifying what they're
arming ICE agents and dehumanizing people who are against their policies. Yeah. yeah. It's very the brown shirts. We'll talk more about this. There's this image, and it's one single page in this story where, again, they've taken over the Capitol and the flags are hung, and you get these kind of old soldiers who come out of the woodwork, the people who have remembered what it was like to be Nazi the whole time. And we're seeing so much of that these days as the ideas spread and the camps kind of polarize. There's no sitting on the fence at a certain point. You have to either stand for or against. And we opened before we started recording. I know you've been protesting. We're recording this in mid-June 2025. Tell our listening audience a little about your protests. I think you're so incredible.
Well, I live in New York, so I'm right near the federal courthouses. And so the park there has been doing from 5 to 7 every single day protests against ICE and, of course, against everything. So, you know, one of them, AOC, came and she was amazing. And then I came upstate and I did the No Kings March up in the country, where you're very divided. There's a very divided populace up here, red and blue. You know, the further you get out of a city, the more red and less blue. And, you know, I'm a big believer in talking to the other side, not having it be, you know, us versus them, because there are more ways that humans are alike than they are unalike.
Right.
And I think that in some ways, it's the rise of the acceptance of fake news. And, you know, you watch the press conferences in the White House now, and you know, all these people like Christy Noem and that Betsy DeVos, whatever her name is, the education, people who have no idea what their job is. They don't have any intelligence about their job, and they just repeat lies, and the lies are amplified. And so this is a cult, really. It's a cult, and it's people. I think AI now, with being able to generate movies and images, it's becoming really difficult to even know the difference between the truth, what's real and what isn't.
Right. And that's either a tool used in the hands of people who want to create a safe space for everyone, or a tool used in the hands of people who are divisive and want to hurt people, right? Like it's so scary to consider the implications.
But I also think that the brainwashing has been going on since Roger Ailes, you know, Roger Ailes and the rise of Fox News. That was their little test case for whether or not you had a populace that would believe lies, that would embrace lies. And that's basically what's happening now. And what the other thing that's interesting is that, it, you know, the agriculture, there was just recently, you know, a pullback on ICE going into certain places, but only red state, you know? It's like, you know, Trump must know this is awful and wrong, because he's not inflicting it on red spaces. He's doing it to blue spaces, you know, going after immigrants.
It's so awful. And this comparison between the sides, it's like that thing where racism exists for Black people, of course. And then white people say, well, yeah, but people are racist against us too. It's simply not the same thing, right?
Yeah, institutional,
historical, entrenched racism is not the same as you feeling like you have to share privilege.
You know, and because I spent years in Haiti teaching film in Haiti, and I was often in situations where I was the only white person, and I never felt even the slightest bit of fear ever anywhere I went. And then we were getting a humanitarian award for our work in Haiti, and we went to the Sarajevo Film Festival, and I brought Kezia, who was one of my students. She was looking around, and Sarajevo is majority white. And we were walking around, and she was like, oh, it's all white people. We're the Black people. And then she went, Annie, is this what you feel when you go to Haiti? And I said, no, not at all. You know, a white person in a sea of Black people, I felt completely safe in Haiti.
Not the same.
I said, it's no comparison, you know. But, you know, of course, it was the film community, so they were very welcoming and embracing of her. But I was like, nah, Kezia, I didn't feel what you're feeling now, you know.
Do you have any final thoughts on the Red Skull or the rise of fascism in America and 50 years later from this story?
No, I mean, I just think it's like insanely relevant, and it's amazing that you're doing this, because it is something to study. All the things that you already so eloquently said about how this story plays out, I think I would hope people in our industry, in the comic industry, please get brave. You know, I mean, if you work for Marvel, you're to a certain degree handcuffed by whatever Disney Disney wants. But I mean, in terms of independent comics, I think it is the time to be as brave as possible, which I can say as an older person. You know, it's much harder to be brave when you're younger and you're at the beginning of your career and you're afraid of being trolled. I would say that we have to get braver.
Doing these historical kind of dives is really fascinating to me. Number one, watching how writers take this concept of fascism with the Red Skull and change it over time, because the way the stories are told in the 40s and the 70s and the 90s are very different as the comic eras change. But we're also recording this. I have an X-Men show, right? You were writing in the Krakoan era where we have a mutant nation and mutant pride. And now in the comics, although they're deftly written and still wonderful, the mutants are in these divided camps where they're being attacked and they're minorities and they're struggling to survive again. It feels aptly weird to recognize that that's kind of how the world feels for queer and trans people right now, you know, especially people who are disabled and immigrants. It's a rough time. So we have to tell these stories. We have to understand it.
Well, and I also think that the X-Men were always, by definition, the other, the hated, hounded other. So even if they had a safe space for a while, and that was wonderful, that whole Krakoa thing and the whole, but they are the hated ones, and that's who they are. So they serve a certain purpose in the Marvel Universe to constantly show how people who are not like the majority are treated. So I think it's okay to go back, you know, to the old school.
Even when we learn to thrive, we still have to learn to survive. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, my friend, I think you are just the most phenomenal person. You're one of my heroes. I'm so grateful for your time today. Thank you. Thank you. I'm going to be in New York this summer. Let's get a cocktail. I would love to see you.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Have a great day.
All right, Annie Nesenti, have fun mowing your lawn.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening to Grey Malkin Lane. We hope you are enjoying this podcast. Grey Malkin Lane is produced and recorded in Salt Lake City, Utah, with music and editing done by my husband, Michael Bell, and promo art done by the incredible Seth Martell. Look for us on Patreon, where we are releasing weekly episodes about obscure characters and facts. It's a great way to participate with the podcast for only just a couple of dollars a month, and it helps support what we are doing here. Also, the best way you could help Grey Malkin Lane is by sharing and liking and subscribing, but also please leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. We'll see you back here next time on Grey Malkin Lane.
First, there was Tuesday. Then there was Taco Tuesday. Now at Wendy's, there's Takis Tuesday. Get a new Takis Fuego meal, a.k.a. Takis Fuego chicken sandwich, Fuego fries inspired by Takis, a bag of Takis Fuego chips, a small drink, and also a small Frosty classic. Yes, you can get that any day, but on Takis Tuesday, the Frosty is free. Make every Tuesday a Takis Tuesday. Gotta be Wendy's.
Limited time only. Participating U.S. Wendy's includes 1 ounce Takis Fuego chips while supplies last. Takis and Fuego trademarks are used under license.